This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 103.5.
It's Thursday evening, 6 p.m. Welcome to the Business Report here on Nova 103.5. My name is Gary Strubel, and for the next hour or so, we'll take you around the world of Namibian business and economics and talk about all things business right here on the Business Report. Robin Sherbourne will tell us about the state of the Namibian economy, a recently released report from him from the IPPR, and a book that he's put out as well, The State of the Namibian Economy. The Prime Minister, Sara Kogongelwa Madila, is in the spotlight this evening. She shares her personal story. We'll go check out what's happening in South Africa. More criminal charges taking place there. Marco Venk from Namibia Breweries joins us and discusses recently released results for the breweries. Fantastic year in review, and some interesting insights about the road ahead for them. And then Valeria Mbangu, a deputy director at the Bank of Namibia, discusses the thorny question of cryptocurrencies and digital assets. That's all happening right here on this evening's Business Report. But before we get into those stories, let's take a look around the world in our Business Flash Briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of BizNews.
With your BizNews this hour, I'm Charlize Maslengle. Namibia's economy grew by 5.4 billion Namibian dollars during the second quarter of 2022 to 48.6 billion Namibian dollars, spurred by real value-added growth in mining, latest statistics show. Namibia has been ranked 103 out of 114 countries globally, according to the 2022 edition of the Digital Quality of Life Survey, compiled annually by the virtual private network provider Surfshark. The European Union on Wednesday promised a robust response to any intentional disruptions of its energy infrastructure after saying it suspected sabotage behind gas leaks discovered this week on subsea Russian pipelines to Europe. And Hurricane Ian blowed into Florida's Gulf Coast with catastrophic force on Wednesday, unleashing howling winds, torrential rains, and a treacherous surge of ocean surf that made it one of the most powerful U.S. storms in recent histories. I'm Charlize Maslengle. Stay tuned for more updates.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Welcome back to the Business Report. You're on Nova 103.5. Time now for our lead story this evening. And the lead story, as always, is proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future. And our lead story this evening is hot off the presses, a presentation, a lecture, public lecture done last night called Waiting for Namibia's Great Leap Forward. A state of the economy, presented by Robin Sherbourne. Robin joins us in the studio this evening. Well, welcome to the Business Report, Robin.
Thanks a lot. Nice to be here.
So let's start out with last night's state of the economy. I have very superficially worked through some of the slides, and I mean the opening slides are pretty alarming. There's not a lot of good news happening there. Did I just not go far enough? Tell us a little bit about what were some of the highlights of the state of the economy.
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, IPPR felt there was an appetite for a public lecture of this sort, the state of the economy. There's no one really giving the public regular information on what's happening and what isn't happening. So we thought that was a good idea, and the turnout was absolutely excellent. 135 people, I think. So the basic story I was telling was the story over the last decade of the Namibian economy and why, basically trying to find explanations why growth disappeared so dramatically in 2016. My angle is that, yes, there were external events, certainly over the past decade. There were droughts and there were slowdowns in Angola and South Africa. There were mineral prices going up and down, especially the uranium price from 2012. But I felt we needed a much more in-depth explanation for why it evaporated so completely in 2012. And my main explanation is that a lot of chickens basically were coming home to roost in terms of bad policy decisions, bad policy making on behalf of the Namibian authorities, and which all sort of combined to slow economic growth down to an absolute trickle from 2016. And then, of course, we were hit by COVID big time in 2020. Growth sank 8%, which is something we've never experienced before. And the economy is starting to recover from that slowly, with a little bit of positive growth. But basically, we're down. And I was trying to offer an explanation why that was so.
We've been engaging the IPPR on a number of issues, as we do, and trying to understand things. And one of the features we presented a month or three ago was outstanding legislation, stuff that was supposed to happen that either hasn't happened for good or for bad reasons. Would it also be fair to say that in many cases a lack of action? So we talk about positive, even if they're bad, you know, positive action, and the policy is a positive action that's been enacted. But it also feels like there's an enormous amount of stuff that just hasn't happened. Government not doing its job in terms of putting frameworks or regulations in place where they need to be. 5G, a case in point.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that? That just seems like there was an inordinate amount of bills like NEEF that were almost being used as threats rather than actually guiding investor policy.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think the whole policy-making machinery, how policy is designed and implemented in Namibia, is problematic. And I think that's why I say the chickens came home to roost. I think you've mentioned NIP. I'd also mention NIPA, the Namibian Investment Promotion Act, which was passed by Parliament in 2016, but is fundamentally flawed. And that's now 6 years ago, and we haven't managed to replace it with anything better. If you're trying to encourage investment as a government, you need that basic framework, that basic investment framework. And investors don't have the confidence, and I'm talking about local as well as foreign investors here, then they're not going to invest. And indeed, I showed some quite dramatic slides yesterday in the presentation of how fixed investment has fallen significantly over the past 5 or 6 years, how foreign direct investment has fallen off a cliff over the past 5 or 6 years. And that's a bad signal for the future, because if this economy is going to grow and create the jobs that we need, you need higher levels of investment. You need to get that legislation and that investment environment in place. And we still haven't done that. We really seem to struggle when we've made a mistake. We really seem to struggle to reverse that mistake, to recognize it and say, we're going to do something about it. We're going to rectify it. And then rectify it and take action.
You also mentioned in the presentation the issue of public enterprises and how badly government generally has fared in fixing and or running these areas.
Yeah.
We have recently seen the liquidation of Namibia.
In
Namibia.
Yeah.
We've seen one or two other things start being rectified. But is this also an enormous reason for the lack of growth? Is it becomes so insular that you can't grow because you're really just moving things around in a cycle.
Yeah, I'd definitely say there's something in that. I mean, I do spend a bit of time in the presentation looking at public enterprises. So we recognize there were problems. We've recognized that for a number of years now, a number of decades even. So we established a Ministry of Public Enterprises in 2015. And I was remarking on the fact that since then we've seen remarkably little real reform. We are hesitant to take the tough decisions that need to be taken. We did that with Air Namibia, yes, but I think our hand was forced. It wasn't part of a longer-term strategy of reform. I present a table of all the commercial public enterprises in the presentation, most of which I highlight in red, because they're either losing money or in trouble in another way, or they just don't produce financial statements, so one can't tell what the hell is going on there anyway. But we're now 7 years down the road from creating that ministry, which is now being merged with the Ministry of Finance, and we haven't really conducted any fundamental reform there.
So when we look at the situation we find ourselves in, there's also little beams of sunlight on the horizon as well. It's not all it's broken
doom and
over, right? There's some good stuff. So I want to ask you about a few, and I just want to start out with what seems to have been a measure of almost arbitrary reform, which tells me that there's a government that's not in sync with itself, through the creation of the NIPBD, who seem on the face of it to have done pretty quickly some pretty impressive work by being given the freedom to do the work they need to do without getting stuck in the bureaucracy of the various ministries, but at the same time seems to have created a little bit of political imbalance now, in that it's almost as if the president has to protect his own chickens, lets them feed where they want, and kind of creates this sense that the ministries might be the actual problem, which of course create some potential political imbalance. So I suppose it's a long lead up to a short question. What is your view on how the NIPBDs come to life and the role that they may play in these attracting these little sunbeams that might come our way?
Yeah, well, there are actually some quite big sunbeams out there, if only we manage to grasp them. I was very excited when the NIPD was created. I thought by housing it within the Office of the Presidency, it would wield a significant amount of power and influence over policy. And certainly I wouldn't have taken the job of leading the NIPDB if there hadn't been a clear precondition to get that investment framework right. As it is, we haven't managed to do that. So we've done what we always seem to do in Namibia, which is when there's a problem with one institution, we create another institution, but we don't adequately deal with the problem. And I fear that's what we've done now, 2.5 years down the road with the NIPDB. Its status is rather unclear. It's housed in the Office of the President. It hasn't managed to get this international investor framework in place. So it's going out there doing quite a good job of selling Namibia. But when investors ask the hard questions, they realize, hang on a minute, you know, this is all very murky and unclear. We're not going to invest. We're not going to go ahead. I think at the same time, they've raised expectations with this $94 billion investment pipeline, but we haven't yet seen any of those investments actually hit the rubber. You know, the rubber hasn't hit the road. So I think the longer time goes on, the more skeptical people will be about the NIPDB, unfortunately.
Second one, obviously, and this links to one of the projects the NIPBD has been able to claim to have landed, and this is, of course, the Hyphen project down in Lüderitz, green hydrogen. Enormous prospects for that whole industry. We spoke to the guys at Hyphen. They reckon it's only 2% of the potential is their project. So it could really be a big game changer for Namibia. We've seen oil finds. We know there's gas. There's general solar. One thing we don't lack is sunshine.
Yep.
So suddenly there's this kind of rumbling that Namibia might, if they get it right, become a bit of an energy hub for Africa.
Yep.
There's even being sort of a not entirely incredible thoughts of joining OPEC. I mean, are we way ahead of ourselves, or could energy be the thing that drags us into this fourth industrial revolution?
Yeah. Well, this is essentially why I called my presentation Namibia's Great Leap Forward, because there are these huge prizes out there some years down the track that we're trying to grasp, and credit to government and the NIPD for doing their best to grasp them. I think those things are there for the taking. I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. And I think there are certain dangers associated with them, but I think there are also huge opportunities for Namibia. And the point I was trying to make is Namibia is going to go through some tough years up until the next presidential and general elections and a bit beyond before these big projects really start bearing fruit. So we're going to have to tighten our belts for a few years, but in the hope that these sunbeams actually burst upon the scene and pull the economy into a different phase of development. I'm very excited about it, but I wouldn't overhype it. I think green hydrogen is very exciting. As I said yesterday, Namibia has become almost a sort of international green hydrogen laboratory. There are all sorts of interesting things going on. The Cleanergy pilot projects, the dual fuel locomotives, the Hyphen project, and even the Hydrogen de France power station, which I was reading about the other day. Lots of very exciting things, but this is a new industry on both the supply and the demand side. Always risks associated with new industries. So you can't time it with a stopwatch and say, look, this is definitely going to get off the ground in a year or 2 years or 3 years. I was also making the point yesterday in the presentation that this is all very exciting, but if you look at our track records in the past of delivering on big projects, it hasn't been that great. And this is hugely ambitious for us. Now, I'm very happy to see that the private sector is in the lead in both cases, oil and green hydrogen, and that's a healthy sign. So I'm very positive about that, and I think Namibia is playing it very, very well at the moment. So I'm hopeful for the future, but that doesn't really get us over the next few years, which are going to be tough.
Just, again, I've had a very precursory glance through the presentation, and David sent it on to me just a little while ago, so I forgive if this is an idiotic question, but it does feel a little bit insular in the analysis in that, and that's not a criticism, it's to lead to the next question. We're also intricately entwined in the South African economy, and that presents some enormous risks that are also out of our control over the next 5 to 10 years. We also have the advantage of a little bit of foresight in watching what's happened to an ANC that hasn't been able to deliver on election promises, to the strength of the institutions like the courts, keeping democracy a faint hope in the future that rationality will win out over politics in the end. How much of an impact do you think watching South Africa, given that it's a 20 times bigger economy, plays on the minds? And I'm not asking you to speculate on what the president sits and thinks about at night, but SWAPO surely has to see a road that goes down that road as well. And here we have to define government and party politics as being separate. We understand that, but they are inevitably sometimes one and the same.
Yeah.
In dealing with these tough issues, is Namibia more motivated to get stuff done, or is it more fearful of making some of the missteps that South Africa has made in trying to deal with these things at a political level?
Yeah, good question. I don't pretend to read the minds of our politicians here, but I would say a number of things. One is that South Africa clearly does have a huge impact on us. They are really our big brother. They have been since independence and before. We're tied to them monetarily. We're tied to them trade-wise via SACU. And we definitely often follow them in terms of policy and policy enactment. Not always, though. I'd also say, though, that we go our own way a lot of the time. And I think we're watching closely what's happening in South Africa. I have to say it's not very pretty. And I think there's every chance of Namibia avoiding that. I think we've already done a much better job in terms of power than South Africa, for example, and we can go into the reasons for that. But I think very often Namibia goes its own way, makes its own independent decisions, and comes out better. I think there's also another angle to it. There are two important issues. One is that it could work to our benefit. I mean, I know South African businesses who would love to relocate to Namibia. And if we get this green hydrogen thing off the ground, if our energy situation improves from where it is at the moment. And there is talk about, for example, slightly overbuilding on the green power and plugging that into our grid and supplying the grid with green electricity. If we can get things like that off the ground, I think there'll be an absolute flood of businesses coming across the border. Now, I know that sounds rather cynical. We're benefiting from our neighbors' problems, but we have to look after ourselves first and foremost. I think the other big question is that of the currency, and I didn't really want to raise this yesterday, but there have been noises. I don't know if you remember when former Minister of Finance Kelly Schlepwein mentioned breaking away from the rand. I think James Manupi has also talked about oil and possibly green hydrogen allowing us to break away. We've introduced the Namibian dollar a few years after independence as an insurance policy because South Africa wasn't then yet a democratic country. Things could have gone very badly wrong there. We've not sort of pulled the trigger on independence, on monetary independence. But I think moving into a whole new period for us, a whole new period of development as a petro currency, I think some very big things could happen on the currency as well. And we might need to move faster if, to put it bluntly, South Africa goes down the plug hole. We might need to do that.
So let's do the plug. You've also invested enormous amount of time and energy in writing a book.
Yes.
These are not simple projects. So tell us briefly, we're nearly out of time, but yeah. Tell us a little bit about your book entitled State of the Namibian Economy.
Yeah, okay. Now, thanks. Well, this is, in fact, the fifth edition of the book. The first one I published in 2009 with the assistance of different sponsors, but it comes out under the IPPR rubric. I've spent a lot of time studying this economy, and one of my passions is to share what I've learned with as many people as possible, politicians, decision makers, business people, and the general public. So I'm always passionate about producing this book of mine, even though it's a labor of love. This latest edition was sponsored by B2 Gold very generously. It's been beautifully laid out. It's been beautifully printed by a local business, John Minot Printers. I think it looks absolutely fantastic. It's 700 pages. It's sort of bigger than the Bible. And rather like the Bible, it's not a book you read from beginning to end. You dip into it when you want to find out a bit about the history of the different sectors of the economy. So I'm hoping this will contribute towards decision makers and the general public's knowledge about their own economy over the last 30 years. It's based on the research I've done over a period of 30 years. And I'm very excited I launched it last week. The response seems to have been very good. It's being given away for the bargain price of 300 NAM dollars. For ordinary people and 150 for students. You just have to contact the IPPR, go there and pay your cash and get the book. And I would love to receive feedback on this book from as many people as possible, even if it's critical and negative. I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I have tracked developments here pretty closely over 30 years.
Thank you. Congratulations. And we'll certainly be making sure we get a copy for our own research purposes. That's Robert Sherborne, economist and a long-time stalwart of the Namibian economy, presented a research piece last night called The State of the Namibian Economy, a bit of a future look at some of the issues that we face in our own looking after our own backyard. Robin, thank you so much for joining us here on the Business Report. And we will certainly be checking in on your next visit.
Right.
And we'll keep up to date as you bring out your quarterly updates as well.
So yeah, I mean, don't forget, I do produce the quarterly. People can subscribe free of charge to this quarterly. It's all the big issues, all the data, everything you want to know about the economy.
That is our lead story this evening. And the lead story was proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
And this evening I'm joined by no other than our Prime Minister, Sara Kugengelwa Amudila. Good evening, Honourable, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So, yes, Honourable, you're our spotlight this week. My question to you is, please tell us about yourself, how your journey in politics began. Did you start while you were growing up, or was it something that you diligently worked towards from the onset?
Thank you very much for that question. I would say that my political consciousness was awakened by incidences that were coincidental, I would say. I grew up in the rural setting. I am the last and youngest child, of course, born to my family of four girls, inclusive of myself and a boy. We eked out a living from a small plot in the rural setting there during colonial Namibia. But both of my parents also had a job outside of the home to supplement what we got from the field. So at an early age, I had this idea already of when I grow up, I must be able to earn an income to take care of my family. But my father worked under the contract labor system, and he was away from home most of the time and would come home towards the end of the year or every year. And through the year, it was mommy that took care of the household and nurtured us and did all the things that men would usually do in addition to working as a principal at the village primary school. And although really I was not conscious of gender issues and I did not understand that to mean here is a woman that is taking care of her family, It also taught me that I need to study and be able to get a job and take care of myself and my children. And I also therefore did not think that being a girl disadvantaged me in any way, because I saw mommy working and taking care of us. And I remember that although her salary was very meager, if I needed something and I go to her and she is not able to provide, she never said, wait for daddy to provide.
Yeah.
So I never really had this idea that men had to provide for their families. I never thought that I should get a husband that can take care of our family. I thought I should be able to take care of myself and my children the way that mommy does. And I think that is really where it started, with believing in myself as a person first and foremost, instead of thinking about myself as a girl and therefore subject to the limitations that are created by society that is patriarchal. That is first and foremost. And having been born in a rural setting, I did not really have exposure to the colonial government officials. So I didn't really understand much what was happening in the country until around the age of 11, when I had to move from the village school to go to another school at Okahau, which was the center in our area there in the Unganjera area. So I went to Okahau, and at Okahau, there was a Kufut base. So that is where I first saw the soldiers of apartheid South Africa. And that was in 1978. It was also the first time that I heard about the military activities of SWAPO and also how the South Africans were pursuing SWAPO in exile in Angola and what they were doing there when the survivors of Kasinga were paraded at Okahao at our school there. I think the idea was to scare us from joining SWAPO, to tell us that if you go there, we will pursue you there and we will deal with you, we will kill you or we will bring you back and lock you up. But what it did to me rather was to understand that, oh, so these people are not defending us, because in Oshiwambo language they were called Etanga Yegameno, so which means it's kind of a protection service. So I started to see them not as a protection service. So I saw them as a service that actually were hurting us, because they are killing our people. And these people that they were parading to us were not even men. They were young women who were in their late teens and early 20s. And really that disillusioned me about them. But to maybe fuel the situation, I was then taught in Standard 3 about how the Europeans arrived in Southern Africa. And these persons kept talking about Jan van Riebeeck arriving in South Africa. And finally, I had to ask this question. Where was Jan van Riebeeck coming from? Then I was told, no, from Holland, somewhere in Europe. So Europeans have not always lived in South Africa. Say, no. And then they moved from South Africa. They came to Namibia. So I asked, so Europeans have not always lived in Windhoek and Swakopmund and in Walvis Bay. They said, no. Then I was like, who lived there? And then the teacher explained to me. Then I'm like, why are they ruling us then? Why are they fighting us when we say we want to govern ourselves? So that's actually how my consciousness awoke. And then my mind became fertilized to the idea of joining the struggle. And that is how, at the age of 12 and a half, specifically, I left the country on the 12th of April to go and join SWAPO in exile. And the activity started there. I became a member of the SWAPO Pioneers Movement. I finished my primary school in SWAPO's education centers in exile, started my secondary school there, got a scholarship to go to West Africa to finish my secondary school, finished my secondary school there, returned to Angola, was inducted into the military. I was trained as a political commissar, where I was taught more about the history of Namibia and the political systems and the importance to empower our people, taking care of them. So for me, freedom was not only about political independence, but it was about the freedom for people to determine their own destiny, to elect their leaders, to determine the policies that must be implemented, to participate in their implementation, and to live a better life. That is really what it's about. Then I came to Namibia. I was mentored. I actually worked at the SWAPO headquarters during the campaign as a petty cash box holder. So I dealt with money, the small monies that needed to be spent. Before independence, I was integrated into the government as part of the transition. I started working in February before independence was proclaimed in March. And at the end of the year, after independence was proclaimed, of course, I was deployed at the State House Office of the President, worked for a few months, and then went to the United States of America at the beginning of 1991. Graduated from there, came back to Namibia. I went back to my old job and started working there before I was offered the position of DG National Planning. And that is really where I had the opportunity to understand the development situation in the country, what needs to be done, and to be able to play a role in coordinating the activities by coordinating the formulation of NDPs, poverty reduction strategy, development budget, coming to finance, dealing with the budget. It gave me an appreciation of the contemporary developmental issues. It enabled me to play a role in dealing with the issues, and it also enabled me to be able to deal with crisis, both during the time of the economic recession, enabling our country to have its first surplus budget and expand important programs like education, health, water supply, roads, stimulating the economy to achieve the highest growth of 6% when I was at the Ministry of Finance. And also at the party, I had the privilege to work at the party companies, and I was able to turn around the party companies, which were about to be liquidated. And I'm proud to see how big they have become now, how they are supporting the party, but also supporting economic activities.
Yeah.
So that's been my journey, really. It's been a journey of being a benefactor of the mentorship, of the solidarity through the sponsorship and education, but also a journey of learning by being involved in programs that made a significant difference in people's lives and also dealing with crisis and overcoming them. This is what I bring to the table as a candidate for vice president's position for SWAPO.
Then, Honorable, what is your favorite pastime? Are you a reader or movie watcher?
I am actually a reader. I also like to listen to music, but I also like to interact with people, to socialize. I am a Libran, after all. I am a people's person.
Oh, okay. That's nice to know. Then, Honorable, how do you compare being the Minister of Finance to being the Prime Minister of the country?
Yeah, there is a similarity in those two positions, first and foremost, because in as much as finance is a line ministry and is focused on public finance management, it also means that you have to interact with other ministers to understand the priorities there, to be able to propose funding to those programs in all the sectors that respond to the sectoral issues there. So that gives that minister a broad overview of the situation in the country, which is similar to what I'm doing at OPM, where I have to coordinate the administration of government. But the main difference with the Ministry of Finance, of course, is that there are also line activities of the ministry that the actual collection of revenue at the time that I was there. There was no outsourcing of the revenue office. We supervised the financial sector. We coordinated the public procurement program. And here I have to now coordinate the general administration beyond just the financial issues. So I have to coordinate both the Ministry of Finance and also other ministries to make sure that the activities are talking to one another and they are mutually supportive of one another. But the OPM is also more of a political office than the Ministry of Finance. That's really the difference, because here you receive everybody, from the traditional leaders to the religious leaders to business people to students to ministries. So this office deals with many more things than the Ministry of Finance.
Yes. Then, Honorable, in which area or sector does your passion lie in the country?
I would say that first and foremost, as a trained economist, and having worked at the National Planning Commission and at the Ministry of Finance, the economy, you know, to grow the economy, because it's the basis for everything at the end of the day. You will not reduce poverty or create jobs if you don't grow the economy. But I also find that maybe because of my personal experience, the fact that I had to leave home at the age of 12 and be taken care of by other people, it made me to understand, to appreciate vulnerability. What it means to be vulnerable at 12 without a father and a mother, to depend on somebody else for your food, for your education, for your health care, it then made me to appreciate that development is not just about the figures, the GDP growth. It should be about the improved welfare conditions for people. So it is growing the economy, but making sure that that growth translates into improved welfare conditions, that we don't have people in informal settlements. We don't have people dying from diseases that can be prevented. It breaks my heart to see a young person who has very good marks not being able to go to university. It breaks my heart to see us being filthy rich as a country with fish and mineral resources, but yet we have a lot of people with poverty. Or to see this dichotomy where you have an informal sector that is predominantly black, in the formal sector that is almost the European standard, but with only people of certain backgrounds, these inequities. So these are the things that give me sleepless nights, and they are my passion to try and address.
Then my favorite part of the spotlight is, I'm going to ask you to pick us your favorite song, Honorable.
Yeah, my favorite song, actually, I would say, is a religious hymn, The Lord is My Shepherd. And I would say that is one of my favorite also verses in the Bible, because it practically says everything that I need to say under all circumstances, you know, different experiences that I'm going through, that I have gone through, that I expect to go through, I think that psalm, you know, is most relevant. And then it translates into the song. So when I'm happy, when I'm confident, when I'm sad, when I'm fearful, that song speaks to me.
What would you want to see being achieved for the country while you're still Prime Minister?
Yes, while I'm still Prime Minister, I want us to succeed with the programs that we are implementing to turn around the economy, because I said it is the beginning of everything. But we need to ensure that the pattern of growth changes so that first we have growth that brings jobs that pay a living wage, so that we eradicate poverty. Secondly, we need to make sure that there is equity in the distribution of those benefits. And I understand that in order for that to happen, the government needs also to improve the services that it delivers to the public, to make sure that there is professionalism in the public service, there is efficiency in the operations of the public institution, that there is good governance and we deal with corruption, so that we do not only stop the diversion of public resources to into the private pockets and away from development programs, but also that we inspire the public confidence in public institutions. That is one. And we also want to see that actually this economy would enable us to diversify and not to just rely on the commodities as has been the case previously, but that we develop the other sectors like tourism and that we harness the power of the IT, and lastly, that we build industries in the country so that we increase the income that we are able to generate from the products that we export. So to process our diamonds and other mineral resources, to process our meat and other crops and the fish, so that we not only create jobs here, but we get more from the sale of those products. And that, of course, we address inequalities, because this is really a time bomb that is waiting to explode.
Yes. How did it feel to be awarded with the Most Brilliant Order of the Sun, second class award, and what does this mean to you personally?
Yeah, it is humbling, first and foremost, to see that people appreciated the contributions that I have made. First, during the struggle for national independence, but also during my service to the Namibian people in the various capacities that I have talked about. So it was very, very humbling, very moving indeed, especially being awarded to me by the person that did, who is a veteran of our struggle. For him to look at what I have done and say, this is worthy of recognizing, it really did move me. Secondly, it also inspired me. So I realized that, well, I can make a contribution that can make a difference, as was demonstrated by this award. So I am inspired to work harder, and that is why I had the confidence to accept the appointment to become Prime Minister, the first female Prime Minister. It is also why I had the confidence to accept the nomination to run for the Vice Presidency, because it was a sort of confirmation to me that my efforts are being recognized as being of significant value addition to what we want to achieve as a country.
Yes. And then you are also very vocal on matters of gender equality. What would your message be to young Namibian females who aspire for a career in politics or to make a difference in their local communities?
I would say to them, believe in yourself, really. Because like I have said, I was inspired first and foremost by my mother. She never ever said to me, Sarah, don't think that because you are a girl, you will not achieve what you want. She just did. Mm-hmm. And by seeing her walking on the field, nurturing us, practically cutting down trees and building the family home, the work that men do, and also go to school, it was showing me in practical terms that your gender does not define what you achieve. It is the confidence that you have in yourself and the efforts that you make that will determine what you will achieve. And therefore, what I say to these young women is, exploit your God-given talents. Exploit the opportunities that come your way through education, through the opportunities to be involved in politics, through opportunities to be involved in business, through the opportunity to climb the career ladder in the public sector or in the private sector. If you put in more efforts, you will achieve the greatest results, as great as those that can be achieved by our male compatriots. Because there is nothing in our biological makeup that makes us different in terms of our ability because we are men or because of we are women. It is all about how much efforts we make and how much we believe in ourselves. And I will say, there are going to be a lot of challenges. There are going to be people that will discourage you. There are going to be people that want to humiliate you when you make a mistake. You should expect that, but you should be determined to pick yourself up even if you fall, knowing that every mistake that you make is an opportunity to learn a lesson that would enable you to do better next time around.
Then a last question, Honorable. Namibia still faces a gender equality gap of note. How long do you think our society will still work on this and eventually eradicate gender equality?
In my personal view, it shouldn't take really long. I know that by extrapolations, the world has looked at the pace at which the world is moving in empowering women. And they are saying it may take several years, decades, and even centuries to bring about gender equality. But I think that can only happen if we don't make adjustments in order to pick up speed. And I think in Namibia, really, we have laid the ground for women empowerment, because we can see the enrollment of the girl child has increased. We can see the progression from secondary school to tertiary institutions for girls has increased. We can see that the graduation by females has increased. We are seeing that in the public sector, the majority of the employees are women. And even when you look at management, their representation are at about 48%, which is close to 50%. So that is an indication that we can actually build the foundation. But we can see that in the private sector, the equity is not so good. But in some industries, look at the financial sector. When I was Minister of Finance, all the heads of these institutions were males. And I used to make consistent calls for gender equity there. And I think that is where the rumor started, that I apparently applied to become CEO of one of the banks, and I didn't make it. That is false. I never applied to be a head of any of the banks. But when you look at them now, most of them are actually headed by women. So we are making a lot of progress in Namibia. And I believe that if we take this action plan, this gender equality action plan that we have adopted, and we implement it vigorously and consistently, and we bring on board the men as partners to understand that when women are empowered, they will also be better off for it. Because when you are a man that is working, earning an income, and your wife is also earning an income, then the family can survive better. It is not a threat to you that your wife is working or that your wife has a better job. If we can keep that speed, I'm confident that Namibia can actually achieve gender equity and gender equality sooner rather than later. And the SWAPO party already has a zebra style. And the representation of SWAPO party in parliament there is the one that has made it possible for us to have that level of representation of women in parliament. So if the other political parties can come on board, if the private sector can come on board, especially with NIEF that we are bringing, I believe truly that we should be able to bring about gender equity. And when we have done that, we will prosper better, because it means that all the talents and all the energy of Namibians, regardless of their gender, regardless of their race, regardless of their ethnic background, is fully mobilized and deployed towards optimizing prosperity for Namibia.
Thank you so much for your time, Honorable. It was lovely talking to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
The BizNews Ramp is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors. M&Z Motors is proud to introduce the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Contact M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group today for your test drive, or visit the M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group Facebook page and check out their great offers. Jeep, go anywhere, do anything. That's me. Welcome back to the Business Report. Every week we get an opportunity to peek over the fence at our neighbors, check out what's going on down in South Africa with our partners, biznews.com. And every week they don't fail to impress us with the range of stories and sometimes just the crazy stuff that's happening. As we speak, Michael Uppel joining us from BizNews. Your lights have just gone off.
Yeah, on cue, hey? Thanks, Eskom. But I mean, we've been having power cuts of about 10 hours or more a day, so I shouldn't be surprised.
It is amazing how efficiently they can run power cuts. If only they could supply the same amount of efficiency to keeping the power on, right?
That's right.
Okay, let's talk about some of the stories on the biznews.com website, some interesting ones. One that that we've been watching with some interest is the Western Cape. A little bit like the kid who got the answer right in the test, and that's what he wants to talk about. There's now a devolution working group. How seriously can we take this, and is it realistic?
So the first people to push for kind of devolution at the most extreme was the Cape Independence Party. They were pushing for a referendum to be held to make the Western Cape an enclave of its own. But there wasn't all that much support for that initially. Now, what's happened is you have this working group that has been formed, and it involves 9 different parties, and it's a mix of political parties and NGOs. So from your DA, Freedom Front Plus, then you also have AfriForum and Ian Cameron's sort of grouping, Action Society, and a host of others, including the Cape Independence Party. So devolution is the transfer of power from one entity to another. And I earlier spoke to Ian Cameron earlier this week. That's up on YouTube. Alex spoke to Helen Ziller, and she is the main driving force behind this working group, which is going to meet, I don't know, I think on a quarterly basis, to discuss how best to devolve power away from a national entity to, in this case, the Western Cape. It's looking at policing, but it's also looking at things like the rail networks and then electricity provision. So can the Western Cape generate its own electricity? Does it have to be so dependent on Eskom? These are all very critical issues. Policing very much in the forefront. The president says the legislation doesn't allow it. Ian Cameron says, quote unquote, you are lying. The Constitution does make provision for it. There's going to be a battle here. All of that up on the website, Gary.
Okay, next story that is almost bizarre. ANC Youth League members are busy in Ukraine at the moment, acting as election observers. How does that come about?
Stranger than fiction. The Russians currently occupy four territories in Ukraine. That makes up about 15% of Ukraine. It's about 90,000 square kilometers. And it's sort of the Crimea, it's the Donbass region, it's Zaporizhia, it's Kherson. And they have, between the 23rd and the 27th of September, held these, what the international community, many of the international community, believe to be legitimate, illegal, sham referendums where they are voting to form part of Mother Russia. And if you look at the polling figures coming out there, it's like high 80s, high 90s, 98% of the local inhabitants there, those who have not fled the Russian guns, that are voting in favor of joining the Russian Federation. Doesn't come as much of a surprise. And the ANC Youth League, of all bodies, finds itself invited to go and be election observers there. Now, how they got invited, who's paying for it, Gary, the most important question, and why on earth they would be chosen is something that needs to unfold and become clearer in the days and weeks to come. I spoke to the Ukrainian ambassador yesterday. She said that they have officially issued a letter of request to the South African government to ask why the governing party's youth league is in Ukraine and how on earth they got there. So there is definitely more to come on this story. I've seen the videos from the ANC Youth League members who are there, and they are saying the people are jovial, the people are free, the people are enjoying democracy and self-determination. They are going to take this message back to South Africans, and they've also, on our behalf, Gary, said that the people of South Africa stand with Russia. It's unbelievable, the sort of statements that are coming out of there. I spoke to Stephen Grudz from the South African Institute of International Affairs. He said that these guys are kind of went down Alice's rabbit hole and came out in a utopian democracy that's being sort of hailed by the ANC Youth League when it's a war zone, Gary. Everybody knows it's a war zone, and the international community has said that this is a sham, and there's a lot of developments on that front.
Well, just consistently amazing how the ANC are unable to keep control even of the most basic international narratives. Another person who could keep control, Mosibenzi Zwane, is in the dock on corruption charges. Things are happening, Michael. Is this at least a ray of sunshine?
This is the very first senior member of the South African former cabinet, but I mean, he sits in parliament now as a heavyweight there. He is the chairperson on the Transport Portfolio Committee, and he's a member of the National Executive Committee of the ANC and a former minister. In this particular context, he's in the dock as a former MEC for Free State Agriculture. He was granted bail of 10,000 Rand yesterday. It's significant, Gary. This is the first heavy, heavyweight that we've got sitting in the dock on state capture corruption allegations. And this is related to the Estina Dairy Project in Frieda, a tiny little sleepy farm, area farming community in the Eastern Free State, and the Guptas came in there, got their tentacles in there, promised that they would uplift the local community and the farmers. They were between 80 and 100 intended beneficiaries who were supposed to be trained up, given cattle, become majority shareholders in this dairy project. Their poverty, their names, their ID numbers, everything was taken to create a veil of legitimacy to this project. Over 280 million rand gets pumped in, and as quickly as it comes in, it gets siphoned overseas to Hong Kong, Dubai, and then comes back to South Africa to pay for the infamous Gupta wedding at Sun City. So the money clearly laundered there. Mosobenz is one here, the first heavy hitter that's in the dock on that. Don't hold your breath. This will take several years. And if they take any cues from Mr. Zuma, who's been fighting his own corruption charges for the better half of two decades, 19 years, these sort of things are not going to be over quickly, Gary.
And I mean, we know Ace Magashule intricately linked with pretty much everything that happened in the Free State at that time and the Guptas. Do we sense that this is also that he'll get snagged on the way in as well?
So he was certainly the political head as the premier of the Free State at the time. He is infamously well known for keeping his signature and his name very far from any official documentation. But as the political head, there is a responsibility of oversight on him. And that is where he potentially could get snagged. But let's not forget, even if they don't get him on this case, he's currently facing corruption and fraud, money laundering charges in relation to an asbestos housing issue also in the Free State. So, I mean, you can pick and choose here. So far, these are complex, complicated cases that took years to investigate. Ace Magashule is already facing charges on his own. Now it's Mosobenz Zwane on the Estina dairy thing. And the Guptas, who got arrested in Dubai recently, they are also related to the Estina matter. So many different facets, many tentacles, many different arms to the spider wheel. It's going to hopefully come to a head at some point.
Right, Michael, we've run out of time. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Maybe light the braai.
Thanks, Gary.
That's Michael Apple from our partners at biznews.com. You can catch those stories, lots of analysis, lots of really interesting columns, and of course still lots of videos from the BNC that was held in the Berg recently. Some really interesting speakers that got up and said their piece, all sorts of different views that you can check out. All of that on biznews.com. That's it for this week's BizNews Weekly Wrap.
The BizNews Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Book your test drive today at MNZ Motors.
Gary Struble on the Business Report.
Welcome back to Nova 103.5. It's the Business Report, and time now for the Market Watch. And we take a look at one of Namibia's stalwarts, an icon of the Namibian economy, Namibia Breweries Limited, who published their results at the end of last week. Joining us in the studio this evening is Managing Director Marco Vink. Marco, welcome to the Business Report.
Thank you for having me, Kerry.
So I suppose we'll start out by just saying congratulations. From my reading, a very good set of results and revenues returning to just under a shade of pre-COVID levels.
Yeah, obviously very pleased from an NBL perspective on the results. I think it was still a very challenging year, make no mistake. I think, our last financial year started off in July of 2021. And as you know, I mean, COVID and the COVID pandemic was still very much prevalent at that stage. And, you know, at that point in time, the Delta variant obviously wreaked havoc in Namibia. So, we still face significant restrictions on trade, especially within the first half of our financial year. But I guess, we did make up for it in the second half and, really worked hard to ultimately get to a really decent result. And I really believe overall a very solid performance for NBL.
So, I mean, one of the standout features for me is the big increase in exports to South Africa. Anything in particular driving that?
Well, I think the benefit that we obviously have, you know, in the sense of operating in different countries is, you know, that that ultimately, you know, one country might struggle while the other one is in a growth spurt. And I think from that perspective, South Africa currently is really in a growth environment. You know, our South African market in essence focuses predominantly on premium, or at least, you know, through Heineken South Africa, which is our partner in SA. And there's a big growth within the premium segment right now in South Africa. And I think, you know, our Vintook brand plays a very important role within that segment. So we've obviously, you know, been very fortunate to be able to, you know, to use this opportunity to ultimately, you know, provide more volume to South Africa in this growth phase. And that has really supported heavily, you know, over the past 12 months. And, you know, the volume growth that we've seen going into SA, you know, was for us, you know, vital to be able to show the great result that we have.
Mark, as a marketer, I'm always interested in activities of retail brands such as yourselves. And Vintook Lager, a sponsor of Griekquiz Rugby, who had an outstanding season. I mean, it's just, do you see the correlation between Griekquiz clapping everyone and the guys consuming more of your product?
Well, I mean, obviously, I would like to say yes, but I think it all probably contributes. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, the Griekquiz performance, and, you know, we're obviously sponsoring the Griekquiz with Vintook Draft. And Vintook Draft is also the big performer for us in South Africa. So I think you can say there might have been a correlation, but I think in general, Vintook is a much loved brand in South Africa as well. And, you know, I think with the great work that Heineken South Africa is doing in driving our brand in that country, you know, and all the initiatives that we currently have to ultimately make sure that the brand is top of mind in from a consumer perspective, specifically within the premium segment, I think, you know, that has really paid off for us. So, you know, South Africa naturally also had a very, very difficult time from a COVID perspective. As you know, they had many more you know, restrictions and you know, even alcohol bans than what we had in Namibia. And I think, you know, for them to come out of that, you know, during the latter part of last year as well as early this year, it really allowed them to ultimately grow significantly over the past, you know, months, 6 months at least. And, you know, we were there to support that growth from an NBL perspective. And I think, yes, Griekquiz has supported that. And I think the way that they played this year, but I guess there's obviously many more factors to it than that.
Heineken SA, you mentioned, also delivering a very healthy dividend back to the group.
Yeah. Heineken SA, again, you know, delivering a great result. I think, you know, it's important. And I guess, again, you know, it's on the back of a very, very difficult period for them within the COVID pandemic environment. But I think they are now also slowly but surely getting to pre-COVID numbers. And that naturally, you know, with currently NBL shareholding of 25% in Heineken South Africa, you know, that obviously supports us as well from a bottom line performance perspective.
It's always interesting to me taking a look at capital expenditure trends that often indicates the investor willingness to put money into the long term. We saw capital expenditure remaining pretty constant, about 140 million. But in your comments, you mentioned expansion of production facilities. Just give us a bit of an idea of what's happening there.
Yeah, I think the intent really is that we want to set ourselves up for growth, you know, over the coming years. So we naturally started that process already in our, you know, in our last financial year that has not passed. And I think, you know, the intent really is to continue that now, you know, during the next financial year, which we already now have embarked on. So the intent really is to set ourselves up for growth opportunities, both, you know, within Namibia, as well as obviously in South Africa. So, and then, you know, we are not even talking about, you know, the plans to grow Vintook as a brand beyond our borders. So, and I think that really, you know, requires capital investment to ensure that we're ready for that growth. And, you know, that's exactly what we're doing right now, is to make sure that we are there when that happens.
Always refreshing to see companies reporting more than a triple bottom line, and your integrated annual report, incredibly interesting to read. I did note environmental outcomes being part of the report as well. And interestingly, a 66% reduction in freshwater municipal water consumption and average water use per litre of beverage produced, down just under 10%. Is there anything in particular you've done differently to achieve those results?
Yeah, I think water, Gary, is important. I mean, you know, the water resources in Namibia in general are very scarce. And I mean, we need to make sure that ultimately we find opportunities to reduce our water consumption. NBL is one of the biggest water consumers in Vinto. And, you know, I think for us, it is vital that at all times we look at how else can we utilize water more efficiently. I think very few people know that we actually are up to 80% self-sufficient. When it comes to our water production, water requirements at NBL, and that is based on the fact that we do have 5 boreholes on our site that allow us to actually extract water and basically put that through a very efficient and highly technical water treatment plant that ultimately, you know, produces water for production purposes, and you know, by that also reducing our need and the requirement from a City of Windhoek water supply perspective. So I think that's number one, is, you know, a great initiative that, you know, we have worked on over the years. And the other one obviously is to try and within our production processes to try and reduce water as much as possible. I mean, you know, we obviously use a certain amount of water to produce, you know, a hectoliter of beer. And at all times we always look at how can we make that more efficient to benchmark against, you know, global benchmarks. And I think the intent really is to reduce that. I mean, new equipment, for instance, is one of the ways that we're doing that. Because, I mean, once you start replacing older equipment that is more water and inefficient with more water efficient equipment, you know, that allows you obviously to reduce your water consumption at all times. But then we also have several other initiatives. I mean, one predominantly being the fact that we do extract more beer from excess yeast, which we have not done in the past. And I mean, you know, that in the past you would have discarded that yeast, and now we basically have a way to extract beer from that excess yeast that ultimately allows us to produce more beer from that as well as reduce our water demand. So all of those things ultimately play really in our favor to reduce our water requirements. And I think, you know, for a country like Namibia where you really have a shortage of water, it's vital that we continue doing that. And I think that's really our intent as well going forward.
Not very commendable. We see operating profit up 9% from last year, just a shade under 670 million, but no dividend being declared. And of course, that links into my last question is, these results, must be noted, are produced under, and a cloud is the wrong word, but under a transaction that's currently in process, in its final stages as well, and that's of course the sale of Namibia Breweries from O&L to Heineken, and an adjacent purchase of Distell at the same time. So a lot of moving parts in creating these results. Just tell us a little bit of the reason for no declaration of dividend, and how is the transaction progressing, and how are you guys handling it all?
Yeah, I think, look, I mean, the dividend and the fact that we have not declared a dividend obviously, you know, has been communicated widely, and that is one of the conditions, you know, that was placed on the, you know, as part of the transaction. So, you know, and I think there's, you know, obviously the intent to pay out an extraordinary dividend once the transaction is completed, you know, which we're hoping will be as soon as possible. But I think the opportunity obviously for future dividends then, you know, once we get back into sort of a normal cycle of dividends is, you know, is improving with this transaction as well. And I think, you know, we've also discussed that recently, you know, with stakeholders. I mean, the opportunities that this transaction, the Heineken transaction, will ultimately unlock for us are significant, you know, whether it is the fact that we will have access to a multi-category brand portfolio, which we currently don't have, because we are a predominant beer business right now, or whether it is to really allow our brand like Vintook to grow significantly beyond our borders, or, you know, utilization of our line capacity at NBL, you know, optimization of supply chains, et cetera, there are so many opportunities that we can unlock with this transaction, which ultimately will bode very well for also for future dividends, you know, once we get back into a normalized dividend cycle. So I think all in all, no dividend right now. That is part of the condition of the transaction. But, you know, once the transaction is completed and the extraordinary dividend is paid out, I think from there on, you know, we're hoping to get back into normal dividend cycles. And with opportunities created through the transaction, we are very comfortable and very bullish about, you know, the opportunities that will allow us to unlock for NBL and the profitability of the business going forward.
So, Marco, just from a personal perspective, this would have been a very tough couple of years to lead any organization, and certainly an organization that plays such an enormous role in such a small economy. Just perhaps a few thoughts on, as you produce great results, what are your feelings over the last couple of years for yourself? And of course, going into another challenging phase.
Yeah, I think obviously, you know, it wasn't without its challenges. And I guess, you know, the most difficult challenge in my mind really was the fact that, you know, we were not just faced with this looming transaction, but also, you know, with the pandemic at the same time. So I think, you know, we really had to juggle balls to make sure that we ultimately, you know, are focusing on all the relevant matters that really ultimately get us to a great result. I think the great thing though for us is, you know, knowing that this transaction can unlock so many opportunities. And I think that really allows us also to have these great discussions with our team. Because ultimately, Gary, for us, it's about the people, right? And I mean, the people really get us through this. And, you know, the support of our team at NBL has been immense, you know, over the past two or so years to really get us through COVID, you know, in a very decent shape, but then also get us through this transaction, you know, to the point where we are now, which is obviously hopefully to be close to having this transaction completed and then moving on in, you know, the new construct, you know, having Heineken as a dominant or as a main shareholder then for NBL. So I think there's a lot of excitement in the business. And I think, you know, it really stems from the great achievements that we've had over the past two or three years. So it's not been an easy time, but it's been a very rewarding time, to be quite honest. And I think, you know, that's what we take out of it is, you know, the learnings at the end of the day. You know, there were so many learnings coming out of this for the entire team. And I think that really matters. And that's something that we can take into the future and really ensure that we now grow the business to the next level.
Mark, I can just tell you that the gang at Future Media, we did our bit as well in helping you produce these results.
Very much appreciated.
Congratulations on a great set of results. That's Mark Mink, Managing Director of Namibia Breweries. Results out in the week. Revenue just over 3 billion, operating profit around 667 million. And of course, we look forward to the closing of that transaction with Heineken towards the end of the year. We'll catch up with him at around about that time. Share price holding steady, up 6% in the month, still off a high of 51 in this year. That's Mark Mink from Namibia Breweries.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 1035.
Welcome back to The Business Report on Nova 1035. And next up is a hot topic. And it's a hot topic because it is an area in which there is increasing pressure on the Namibian economy. The Bank of Namibia last week hosted a thought leadership event under the theme Central Banking, Digital Currencies and Virtual Assets. And today we are fortunate to talk to Valeria Mbangu, Deputy Director of Strategy, Projects and Transformation at the Bank of Namibia. So we assume we're talking to exactly the right person who can answer our questions. Valeria, welcome to the Business Report.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, one of the things that came out of the governor's address was the fact that virtual assets are still not considered legal tender in Namibia, but merchants can choose to accept them as payment at their discretion. Is this a softening in stance for the bank that has previously been quite vocally anti-VAS?
Well, thank you very much for the question. I think it's a good question. As a bank, our position on these concepts and innovations is not static. It's constantly evolving, and we are remaining informed just by surveying the domestic landscape and really pairing this view with global standard setters as well as regulatory requirements, such as those issued by the Financial Action Task Force, FATF. And when and if required, we then go ahead and change our position as required. And maybe just to give some context to the listeners, previously, the bank issued two position papers that provided a formal position on distributed ledger technologies, DLTs, and virtual assets. This was also done with the intention of communicating and educating the public on these emerging financial technologies. This position at the time strongly discouraged any engagement and activities really related to unregulated virtual assets such as Bitcoin. So in essence, the bank didn't recognize nor did it support or recommend the possessing, utilization or trading of virtual assets in Namibia and by members of the public. And similarly, the bank strongly discouraged the practice of soliciting funds from the general public to invest or trade in cryptocurrencies on their behalf. And any person that was found to be in contravention of the Banking Institution Act with respect to conducting banking business or illegal financial schemes would be prosecuted in accordance with the relevant laws and bylaws. The letter also prohibits the mobilization of funds by certain promoters from the public towards claim trading and investment activities which are in conflict with the laws that guide how deposits need to be taken from public members. So how has that changed? The bank recently revisited its position. The Bank of Namibia Act only still recognizes the Namibian dollar and South African rand as legal tender in Namibia. And as such, the position remains that virtual currencies remain without legal tender status. Furthermore, the definition of payment instruments in the Payment System Management Act does not extend to virtual assets. So in essence, the current regulation actually does not prohibit the use of virtual assets to pay for goods and services, notwithstanding the fact that the bank strongly cautions users against the use of virtual assets as a method of payments due to the risk that is associated with virtual assets. And most importantly, this needs to take place really at the discretion of the merchant and the buyer. I would also just like to reiterate the fact that public members who own, utilize, and trade virtual currencies do so at their own risk. And if there's any misfortune or losses that are incurred, there will be no recourse to the bank. To support innovations as per the strategy of the bank, however, we have taken a game-changing decision to bring virtual asset service providers under our regulatory ambit through the Bank of Namibia Innovation Hub. So the hub recently conducted a survey to engage fintech players to better understand the landscape of virtual assets and virtual asset service providers in Namibia. And I'm really pleased to report that the discussions between the fintech community and the hub were very fruitful, and it gave us a better understanding of their operations. And to continue forging these relationships, the bank amended its stance to bring virtual assets and virtual asset service providers under its fintech innovation framework. This in the short term to register the virtual asset service providers under its fintech innovation framework, and in the long term, as mentioned, amend applicable laws and regulations diligently in consultation with relevant authorities such as NAMFISA. The revised approach will be done in a phased and structured manner to ensure effective dialogue between all parties involved and to adequately assess all the risks that are related to virtual assets through the fintech program.
Wow, thanks, Larry. Okay, that's a lot of answer. So let me perhaps just ask you one or two basic questions that people in the street want to know. Mm-hmm. If people wish to trade in crypto, is that going to be allowed? And do we see the envisaged outcome of this whole process that cryptocurrencies will eventually become accepted as legal tender?
As previously mentioned, the position of the bank remains that virtual assets or virtual currencies remain without legal tender status. And members of the public who choose to participate in these activities will have no recourse to the bank in the event that there are any financial losses or any misfortune. And further to that, if those activities themselves, are in conflict with any laws, the appropriate actions would be taken, as cryptocurrencies and related activities could be used as a platform for illegal financial activities like pyramid schemes, unauthorized banking business, money laundering, and the likes. However, the growing interest in virtual assets in that ecosystem, they pose a distinctive and unprecedented challenges to the financial authorities around the globe. I don't think it's necessarily unique to Namibia. However, the bank is of the view that virtual assets and virtual asset service providers cannot remain outside of the Namibia regulatory realm, and that collaborative engagements between policymakers, regulators, private sectors should be encouraged to foster an inclusive and innovative financial system. The end goal is really to create a conducive environment to foster innovation while gathering as much data as possible on these new technologies to really help us formulate use cases that will not only benefit the Namibian people, but also for us to be able to maintain financial stability.
Of course, when speaking of virtual assets and cryptocurrencies, it's not just about Bitcoin and the like, because many governments and central banks are looking at launching their own digital currencies, something the Bank of Namibia is apparently also doing. Are we going to see an electronic Namibia dollar?
Firstly, let me take the opportunity to make a distinction between virtual assets and a CBDC, in other words, a central bank digital currency. A virtual asset, according to FATF, is any digital representation of value that can be digitally traded, transferred, or used as a means of payment. It does not, however, include digital representations of fiat currencies issued by a country's central banks. CBDCs are a representation of fiat currency. In other words, it would be the same as cash issued by a central bank, such as the Namibian dollar, just in a digital format. So as it relates to central bank digital currencies, the bank is still at an exploratory stage. So it's really early stages. In fact, the aim of the thought leadership event that was held last week was really to create dialogue and mutual learning among central banks on their journeys in exploring and adopting central bank digital currencies and overseeing virtual assets, so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel because others have walked a mile on this journey. People are really only willing to trust and accept money today because they know that everyone else will do the same thing tomorrow. Therefore, trust and acceptance of currency is a fundamental element that ensures that the stability of the monetary system is maintained. Trust and acceptance of the Namibian dollar, whether it's going to be in the form of notes, coins, a CBDC, should be preserved.
Okay, thanks, Lira. We're nearly out of time, so I'm just going to ask you one last question. Thank you for explaining all of those to us. Now, there were representatives from various central banks at the event, including Nigeria, Ghana, and South Africa. That would indicate that there's quite a collaborative approach to this problem, which I'm sure is vexing many a central bank all around the world. We know the U.S. central bank equally is vexed by this issue and with far more technological pressure on them. For many years, however, if we look at some of the free trade agreement, the African Union, a number of initiatives that are trying to find ways to explore how African nations can best benefit from working together. One of the ideas for a long time has been a single African currency, much like the euro. Could a virtual asset make that dream finally come true?
I think that the idea of a single African currency is still years away because the continental leaders have agreed to first work on political and economic integration amongst the regional blocks, before pursuing a monetary configuration and ultimately the issuance of a currency. Therefore, at a SADC level, for instance, work is underway to ensure macroeconomic convergence of member states, which is paramount to any discussion of a single currency, even at a SADC level. And I think with that said, digital currencies will follow the same route as they are merely representations of the fiat currency in a digital format.
Okay. Valeria Mbangu, the Deputy Director of Strategy Projects and Transformation at the Bank of Namibia, thank you so much for joining us here on the Business Report. It's still a long road to walk, but surely got to be quite an exciting one for you guys as well.
Certainly.
Valeria, thanks for joining us right here on the Business Report.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. The Business Report, Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 103.5.
I'm David Bishop with your weekly economics wrap. South African-based independent airline Airlink announced that it has acquired a 40% stake in Fly Namibia, something public and media relations advisor of IATA, Lyndon Burns, says is a good sign.
It's an incredible vote of confidence in Namibia, in its people, in its attractiveness as a destination, not just for leisure tourists, but also for business, and a huge vote also of recognition of the economy and the massive potential that it holds, especially now with the emerging green hydrogen sector, and they're going to have a catalytic impact on the rest of the economy and on other businesses. And increasingly, there's going to be demand for air connectivity, not just to Windhoek and to Walvis Bay, but to other sectors. centers of the economy around the country and to be able to link them to new markets.
The viability of Meatco's sustainability has been brought into question by auditors after the company made a loss of 206 million Namibia dollars. High Economic Intelligence junior analyst Arnie Charonda says the country has been experiencing mild recession-like behavior since 2017. The economy expanded by 5.6% during the second quarter of 2022 compared to 5.5% registered in the corresponding quarter of 2021. And Trustco is challenging the Bank of Namibia's decision to not allow Trustco Bank to enter into larger-scaled operations on numerous constitutional grounds. But the BON says that it will vigorously defend its supervisory actions to ensure that the country's financial system remains sound and stable. In other local news, a study of the housing crisis in Namibia by the Integrated Land Management Institute has shown that over 90% of Namibian households would not qualify for a mortgage from any commercial bank. The Ministry of Mines has told parliamentarians that it intends to amend the law to allow not less than 20% of shares in diamond licenses to be held by Namibian citizens. And despite the introduction of the credit guarantee scheme for small medium enterprises, the Namibia Chamber of Commerce and Industry says more should be done to relax collateral and security requirements against loans. In news that everyone thought they already knew, South African ANC presidential hopeful Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma says Eskom's failure to generate power could be solved by having sufficient capacity, proper maintenance, and a better energy mix. Meanwhile, President Cyril Ramaphosa has conceded that his government will not eliminate the current massive rolling blackouts in the short term and that the goal is instead to reduce the frequency and severity of the blackouts in the immediate term. Not to be outdone, Nigeria's national electricity grid collapsed on Monday, leaving many parts of the country without power. While in other news from the rest of the continent, the United States says it will not remove sanctions placed on Zimbabwean entities and people. Newly elected Kenyan President William Ruto has expressed willingness to purchase fuel from Russia, despite a number of nations, notably the United States, avoiding engagement with Russia as a result of its invasion of Ukraine. And African leaders welcomed the new firm Sovereign Africa Ratings after dissatisfaction was expressed over the systems used by ratings giants Standard & Poor Global, Fitch and Moody's when evaluating sovereign debt in Africa. The UK government insists it's sticking to its plan for the economy despite scathing criticism from the International Monetary Fund, which says the country should reevaluate its package of tax cuts, which will worsen inequality and increase inflationary pressure. And in a sign of growing ties between Russia and India, Moscow has said it wants to partner with Delhi on 5G technology. And sticking with Russia, the country has rejected suggestions it was behind explosions on two gas pipelines which are leaking gas in the Baltic Sea.
Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
Another packed show. Thanks for staying with us if you managed to make it all the way through. If you didn't and you want to catch up on some of these stories or perhaps some of our previous episodes, you can get along to your favorite podcast store on both Apple as well as Android. Go check it out. Business Report, Namibia's leading business show, available on all those platforms, as well as on our website, nova.com.na, all of our previous episodes there. Let us know what you think. Let us know what you want to hear about. And give us some feedback. We absolutely welcome it, whether it be good or bad. Thanks, as always, to the guys and girls who put the show together. Angie Schultz, our producer, David Bishop, for his contributions, and then Raymond Ziefeld, our technical producer, for putting it all together. But mostly, thanks to you for listening. We couldn't be Namibia's leading business show without you dialing in every Thursday right here on Nova 103.5. Have a wonderful weekend.
That was the Business Report on Nova 103.5. Listen to all the segments and previous episodes with our podcast service on nova.com.na. The Business Report was presented by Gary Strubel and produced by Angie Schultz and David Bishop. Comments and questions can be sent to tbr@nova.com.na.